Chapter 23. The Torment. The fire had been burning for a while. At first it was far away, down in the darkness where no one could see it, just a dull red glow roiling in the blackness. It looked as though it would never be serious, never really catch hold, that it would burn itself out and grow cold. But fire has been deceiving man since it was first given to him by the gods, or since he first stole it from them. Stories differ. The only truth that matters is that fire likes to betray. It has burned man's hand since first he took possession of it. When he thinks it is extinguished, it leaps back into life and reveals itself in fury, suddenly overwhelming, all-consuming, and too strong to fight. So with this fire. From the dullest glow to a seething inferno, from nothing to everything in the beat of a heart, taking hold, devouring all, leaving nothing but ashes. Its heat was upon him, stifling him. Its light was in his eyes. His skin was blistering and flaking. His bones were beginning to fuse and melt. He heard the constant rattling of the loom, spinning towards eternity, despite the conflagration that enveloped it. But the noise of the loom and the roaring rush of the fire were both drowned out by the cheering in the air, the clicking whispers, the sounds of a trillion invisible insects stridulating in the back of his mind. He could bear the heat no longer. He was being burned away. The door to the dark room was open, and hard sunlight shafted in from outside. Despite its glare, the light looked cool compared to the flames that lit him from head to toe. He got up to reach for it. He pulled his burning body from the rough cot to claw at the light.
"Stay still," the robed man said gently.
"I burn," he gasped.
"It is the torment," the man told him. "I'm sorry. This is what it does. We have tried many things to ease the pain. Stasis fields, ice baths, opiates, induced coma. Other victims have told me that it burns like hell's fury, even in their dreams."
"Is this a dream?"
he asked. His voice was small, without substance, like burning paper lifting into the air as it crisped away.
"I'm sorry, no," said the robed man. "Lie back. You are too weak."
"I will get up," he insisted.
He hauled himself up. The robed man reached to steady him. "Why aren't you burning?" he thought. "I am on fire. You touch me. Your hands are on me. Why aren't you burning too?" He shuffled to the open door. The robed man supported him.
"I don't know your name," the robed man said. "You were brought to us in this condition. You carried no identity. These are the first words you have spoken."
My name is Gregor. Gregor Eisenhorn."
"I will do all I can to help you, Gregor Eisenhorn,"
the robed man said softly. They stepped out into the light. The air was humid. He could see the deep blue sky above. He could smell the sea. Beyond the old stone walls of the garden, lush green vegetation rose, the skirts of a rainforest that blanketed the sheer flanks of the volcanic flue that stood in the distance, a ghost in the heat haze. The churring of the insects was louder, uncountable insects chirping in the jungle thickets beyond the ancient walls.
"Where is this?"
Eisenhorn asked, squinting in the bright sunlight.
"Is this some other part of Kestra?"
"I don't know where that is,"
said the robed man. His robes were pure white. His skin was very dark.
"I haven't heard of it. Is it where you were?"
"Then have I folded again?"
Eisenhorn asked.
"Is this another X-Timate overlap?"
"I'm sorry, my friend," the robed man said. "I do not understand the terms you use. Gregor, your fever is so high it cannot be measured. You are hallucinating, I think. Hallucinating and confused. You have contracted a pestilence. It is called Ulrin's pox. It is severe, I'm sorry to say. Your confusion is part of the illness. I should return you to your bed."
Eisenhorn looked at him.
"Are you one of Goblika's people?"
he asked.
"I don't know the name, Gregor."
"Are you a doctor? A medicae?"
"I care for those who come here,"
the robed man said.
"I am Baptrice."
Eisenhorn looked around the garden. His raised voice had attracted attention. Three sisters, in stark white robes and starched bicorn wimples, observed him with concern. A grizzled old man sat on a garden seat beside the wall. He was naked, except for an old ammunition belt, and his left arm was nothing but a mass of old scar tissue. He was putting brass shell cases into the loops of the bandolier, and then taking them out again, counting each time.
6, 7, 8. 6, 7, 8.
What is this place?
Eisenhorn asked.
The hospice of St. Bastian, the robed man said.
On symbol iota?
Eisenhorn asked.
Yes, said Baptrice. You know where you are, then.
What year is it, sir?
Gregor, it is the third year of the Genovingian campaign, and...
Eisenhorn broke free of his hands and walked out onto the lawn. The insects were so loud.
Gregor, called Baptrice. You are lucid. I have never seen such lucidity in a patient so tight in the grip of the torment. I would like you to speak with someone, if you are able. He might learn a great deal from you.
Who?
Asked Eisenhorn.
His name is Sark, said Baptrice.
Draven Sark?
No, sir, said Baptrice, frowning.
Lemuel Sark.
Higher Administrator Medica Lemuel Sark. He is visiting us. His speciality is Materia Medica, and...
I want to leave now, said Eisenhorn.
That cannot be permitted, said Baptrice, sadly.
Why are you showing me this?
Eisenhorn asked.
Showing you? What?
Asked Baptrice. Eisenhorn wasn't talking to him. He was staring down at his own hands. Old hands, marked with old scars. Hands that were dirty with soot and machine oil. Hands that were covered in yellow blisters from the fire that was eating him away.
Why are you showing me this?
He asked the fire in his blood.
This is your place of birth. Where the truth of you crossed Sark's path and the connection was made. Where the infection began. Carried not as a disease, but as an idea. From father to son to grandson.
Sisters, Baptrice called.
There was worry in his voice.
Help me conduct this poor soul back to his confinement. He is delusional and very sick. I fear for his safety out here.
The sisters approached. Their robes were ice white, and their horned cowls trembled as they walked. There were more of them than before. 10, 15.
Come, Gregor, said Baptrice. Let me take you back. Let the fever run its course. There is hope yet.
There was no patient with the torment housed in this place, said Eisenhorn. No outbreak occurred here at the hospice. It was an asylum. There was only a survivor. One man, an inmate who had survived the pandemic. I have read the reports. This is a lie. You are a lie.
Help me with him, Baptrice smiled.
The sisters closed around, their white bicorn wimples like tusks in the sunlight. More of them now. 40, 50.
I want to leave,
said Eisenhorn.
Restrain him gently, Baptrice said. He knows not what he says.
The sisters surrounded him. There were more of them now than there were chirring insects in the jungle outside. Eisenhorn staggered through them, brushing aside their phantom hands and their snow-white robes. He started to walk, pushing them aside. Somewhere, a cloister bell began to ring. He reached the iron gate in the old garden wall. Beyond, the green darkness of the jungle swarmed with the fricative words of insects. The flames swirled around him. He opened the gate and stumbled through.
I suppose you get a lot of cases like mine,
sniffed the small man waiting for him on the other side of the desk.
Cases?
Asked Eisenhorn. The room was cool and grey, as if it were raining outside, or the place were always starved of light. There was a large ornamental fireplace that clearly had not seen a fire in centuries, a rug on the wooden floor, and two plain chairs on either side of the desk. The old man sat in one. A gilt clock stood on the mantel, ticking like an insect in a jungle thicket, steady and slow.
You may take a seat,
the small man offered.
Of your own volition. You might as well be comfortable. We're here to talk.
Eisenhorn sat. The old man was shriveled and bent, lost in the folds of his hand-me-down robes.
"You get a lot of cases like mine,"
he sniffed.
"I don't understand,"
said Eisenhorn.
"Oh, you understand. You understand, sir. You just don't care. And because you don't care, you don't remember."
"What am I supposed to remember?"
asked Eisenhorn.
"The people you have ruined,"
said the man.
"How many is it? Lost count. I'm sure you remember the truly great ones. Pontius Glaur, you'd remember him. Stopping him was the making of you. Or was it the breaking? What about the others? The nondescript ones? The minor cases? The insignificant ones? The innocent? Do you remember them? Or are they just faces that passed you by? Do you remember me?"
"I remember this room," said Eisenhorn. "I remember that clock, ticking like—"
"Oh, you remember the room, do you? That's nice," said the man. "Of course you remember this room. It's where you brought them to, all of them. This room and 1,000 like it. A room in which to talk. A room in which to slowly dismantle a man's life. How many lives is it now? How many have you brought here? Not the notorious, vile ones. I mean the ones like me. The unfortunates. The ones who walked in off the street, troubled by some minor transgression, only to find they were going to be rendered down. Their pride, their hopes, their dreams, their lives, their livelihoods, their possessions. Did you pause to care for any of them?"
"I don't remember you," said Eisenhorn.
"Rather my point, interrogator,"
the man said.
"Is it interrogator still? It was then. I'm sure it isn't any more. What are you now?"
"Nothing," said Eisenhorn.
"Then we are turned about, sir,"
said the small man.
"For last we met, I was nothing to you. My name is Imus. Does that stir anything?"
"No."
"No, of course not. You have always been very good at your job, sir. Very good. You have excelled in your duties. Shall I tell you why?"
"I feel you're going to, Master Imus," said Eisenhorn.
"Because you never care,"
said Imus.
"You are without compunction. This allows you to perform your duty with intense purpose. No sentiment gets in the way."
"Drusha said that," murmured Eisenhorn.
"Drusha?"
asked Imus.
"Friend of yours?"
"No."
Imus grinned.
"I knew the answer would be no, you see,"
he said,
"because you have no friends. No one comes close to you. You do not allow them to. A connection with another soul would be weakness. Which is why 100,000 people have passed through this room, and you have disassembled them all, and you cannot even remember their names. Now this heartless bearing of yours explains why you are very good at what you do. But it begs the question, why do it at all?"
"Why do it?"
Eisenhorn asked.
"Yes, yes, keep up. Why devote your life to the protection of mankind when you cannot abide the close connection of another human being?"
"Ordo service is hard," said Eisenhorn. "One must put aside certain things. One must stand apart and keep to the shadows. It—"
"Poppycock,"
said Imus. He drummed his bony fingers on the desktop.
"The ruinous powers, in your expert opinion, are they a contaminant?"
"Yes," said Eisenhorn.
"Like an infection, a disease. Once contracted, even from the briefest contact with a carrier, never cured."
"Yes,"
said Eisenhorn. The insect tick of the clock was scratching at his mind.
"It is the greatest horror of the warp. It never leaves a man once it has stained his hands. Corruption is inevitable."
"Yet you have touched it, sir."
"An obligation of my work,"
said Eisenhorn.
True,
said Imus.
Also true, and a fact you know well. All inquisitors end. They are, by necessity, finite. The work they do, how can I put it? It tarnishes them. They are carriers, infected with the torment of their duty. No matter how noble and dedicated, it gets them all in the end, doesn't it?
The Inquisition has safeguards.
Indeed it does,
said Imus.
Retirement from active service, restraint, incarceration. The Inquisition watches itself. When one of its own goes too far, becomes too lost, he is declared heretic as quickly and undeniably as any arch-enemy rogue.
That's how it must be.
But you consider yourself an exception?
Asked Imus. No, I... Eisenhorn paused.
You always knew the path you were walking. You knew the cost. You knew the inevitable.
I always accepted that.
But now you deny it,
said Imus.
For so many years, sir, they tried to get you to stop, to retire before it was too late. Your friends, forgive me, I misspoke, the people you described as your friends, they all tried, didn't they? And you ignored them, because you knew better. You overruled them. You cast them aside. They stopped being the people you described as friends. Some died, and you never cared. Some battled you to halt your progress, and you crushed them for it. And now you're here, in this room. Even the holy orders, which you claim to serve so dutifully, have declared you a heretic. Diabolus extremis. And yet, they are wrong, because you know better. You will disregard their authority and carry on anyway, alone and friendless, though you always were, claiming to serve the Inquisition, even though it no longer wants your service.
I know things that... Imus held up a hand so small and scrawny it looked like a bird's claw.
No one's listening any more, sir,
he said.
Not even you. Look at yourself. Broken beyond measure. Obsessed. Serving on for decades beyond any point that is wise or healthy. Always driving forward because you know best. You serve mankind, but you have only contempt for the people who cross your path. You use people. You neglect any bonds that might be considered friendship and which constitute the foundation of humanity. You forget the faces and the names of those whose lives you change. People die for you, and you care not.
Imus pushed back his chair and rose to his feet.
You should think about it, interrogator,
he said.
Why you do what you do.
I know why, said Eisenhorn.
The thing is, you poor fellow, you don't. And it's right there in front of you, the truth, staring you in the face. You're so good at finding the truth, yet you fail dismally to find it in yourself.
And what is the truth, Master Imus?
Eisenhorn snapped.
Look at yourself, sir, and tell me what you would call a man like you,
said Imus. Eisenhorn shifted in his seat uncomfortably. He looked at his hands and saw how badly they were seared. Blisters, contracture, third-degree burns, perhaps fourth. From the fire inside him.
Sir?
Imus called out.
Are you quite well? You look rather ill at ease.
I'm burning,
whispered Eisenhorn.
Like last time?
Asked Imus. What?
When last we sat together in this room, you caught fire. Head to foot, I was most terrified. The fire, it burned your skin and roasted the flesh off your bones until nothing was left except a torched skull staring back at me.
That wasn't real, mumbled Eisenhorn.
No, it wasn't,
said Imus.
It was a trick. A wretched trick of your psychic mind. You did it to scare me, to make me quail.
It worked. By throne, it worked. The most terrible thing, and I have never forgotten it, or forgiven you for scaring me like that. Do you remember why you did it?
To elicit a response.
To elicit a response,
cried Imus. He smiled and opened the glass front of the clock on the mantel.
That's it exactly. You did it to scare the crap out of me, pardon my language. It was intimidation, bullying. You've done that your whole life. You did it to get at the truth. Do you remember what you said about that?
No,
said Eisenhorn, racked with pain.
You said that fear simplifies the mind, said Imus.
You said it is so strong and pure, it empties the head and removes all barriers and falsehoods. You scared me so you could read the truth inside me, the honest part of me that I could not dissemble.
It was a technique, replied Eisenhorn, fighting to remain conscious. He rose to his feet, found he was too unsteady, and sat down again.
A standard Ordo technique. Just a mind trick. The fire burning me is real.
Imus craned his reedy neck and peered at the face of the clock. He began to adjust the hands.
Real?
He asked, as if only half listening.
What's real? Look at us here, in this room. What's real about that? It's just another technique, another mind trick, another phantom fire to burn through to the truth, to, how did you put it, empty your head and remove all barriers and falsehoods. Fear, sir, to simplify the mind.
No, said Eisenhorn. He took a deep breath. A shadow seemed to have passed over what little daylight existed outside, and the room was darker than ever.
It is the torment, the antigenic at work. It's a hallucination. Sark designed the inoculant to condition the mind, to strip away the will, to brainwash.
No, he didn't,
said Imus mildly.
That's not really what it does. It doesn't make you think differently, sir. It makes you think truly. It burns away all the psychological armor and rationalizations and excuses a man has accumulated through his life and shows him the truth that's always lurked underneath it all. Like fear, it simplifies the mind.
Eisenhorn rested his face in his hands, his elbows on the edge of the desk, and concentrated to control his breathing and moderate the agony.
I'm weary, he said quietly. Of people telling me that I've crossed some arbitrary line. It's not the truth, and this delusion won't convince me otherwise. You're just an old memory, being used as a puppet by the torment antigenic to get me to confess to something that isn't true.
Of course it isn't true,
said Imus.
You haven't become a heretic. You are quite right to be resolute about that. Why, that absolute certainty is what helps you remain so defiant against accusations. You can conscientiously insist you have not become a heretic, no matter what your old masters say.
Eisenhorn looked at the old man.
The real truth,
said Imus, with a smile,
the thing we've met in this room to winkle out of you, is far more simple. Will you admit it to me?
I don't know what.
Then I will say it,
said Imus.
The warp has always been in you, right from the start. It has called to you, and you have followed it. You wear the robes of an inquisitor to get close to it, and you finish any who dare compete with you for its affections. You are not a heretic because the Inquisition has proclaimed you one. You have not slowly become a heretic after years of stalking the dark. You have always been one.
Imus grinned at Eisenhorn.
You must know that's the case,
Imus said.
Well, you must get a lot of cases like yours. You came to this place of your own volition. You know what happens in this room.
You have always been a heretic, Gregor Eisenhorn. You simply haven't ever had the clarity to recognize the fact. You do now. The barriers are burned down. Fear has simplified your mind. You cannot dissemble.
No,
said Eisenhorn. He rose to his feet.
Come now. Don't threaten me,
said Imus. He finished adjusting the clock and closed its case.
I've been dead for 200 years. You have never lived. You do not walk in darkness. You are darkness. It's always been too late to turn back. It's in your blood, like a fire that won't go out. You should accept it. That's what you told me, and 100,000 like me. Accept your transgression, and you will find relief. A burden lifted. Embrace it. The warp is your only friend, and it's been waiting for you for a long time.
Eisenhorn felt the flames rise up, eating at him eagerly.
This is trickery, he insisted. Fever!
No,
replied Imus.
It's the truth, which is always the most painful thing of all. End your torment, sir. Accept what you are. Acknowledge what you have always been. The pain will be brief. Beyond the pain, why,
it is so very beautiful.
Eisenhorn shook his head. Fire was gnawing his bones away.
You think the warp is your enemy,
said Imus.
But it's the only true thing there is. The one constant. Your only friend. Species rise and fall. Imperiums come and go. The warp remains. Bow down and let it take you. It's what you've always secretly wanted.
The door banged open.
Will this take much longer, Gregor? Asked Titus Endor. I've got things planned.
Imus sniffed and looked at the clock.
About time,
he murmured.
I was getting bored of this.
Endor drew his auto-snub and shot 4 rounds into the old man. Imus fell into the fireplace and smashed into 100,000 fragments of old Summiter-ware pottery.
Come on, said Endor, grinning. There's still time to get out. There's always time to get out.
He took Eisenhorn by the arm and bustled him out of the gloomy room.
You'll burn yourself, Eisenhorn said, looking down at Endor's hand, gripping him.
Anything for a friend, laughed Endor. You and me, through thick and thin. You knew I'd always come back, if you needed help.
From the dead.
Endor halted and turned to face Eisenhorn. He put his hands on Eisenhorn's shivering shoulders and looked into his eyes, serious and sober.
Is this about the thing? Endor asked. The business. It turned things bad between us, I know. Tell me you've forgiven me. You must have forgiven me by now. It wasn't my fault, you know. Just circumstances.
Eisenhorn looked away. He couldn't meet Endor's urgent gaze any more. There were things in Endor's eyes, writhing worm things like larvae, that pressed against the glossy windows of Endor's eyeballs. He looked around instead. A huge full moon, the color of flame, was rising over the desert flats. The vast sky was woad blue, speckled with stars. The endless sands were turmeric yellow. There wasn't a building around for 100 kilometers.
Is this another stage of the fever? He asked.
The what?
Asked Endor. He began to walk, his boots kicking up fine dust from the soft yellow sand.
Another part of...
Look, forget it, Gregor, will you? Endor said. I let you down. I shouldn't have. I'm sorry. Can we leave that business behind us? Come on, I've got to get you out of there.
You shouldn't consort with me, said Eisenhorn. I will destroy you.
I don't need you for that, snorted Endor.
I am disavowed and declared heretic.
Well, you've always been a bit of a rogue.
I mean it, Titus. The Ordos have cast me out.
They got rid of me too, you know, said Endor. Said I was, you know, unreliable. Took my rosette. Put me out to pasture. What does it matter? I've known you a long time, Gregor. I know what you are.
And what is that?
Asked Eisenhorn. A sweet desert breeze rose, and dust swirled between them like smoke.
A friend,
replied Endor, with a smile and a shrug.
"I was never much of a friend to you," said Eisenhorn.
"Ah, I got used to you. And your ways," said Endor.
"I let you die," said Eisenhorn. I think I knew you were sick. I suspected. I knew I couldn't cure you, but I could have come to find you. Made your last years more comfortable."
"You could have done," said Endor. "But let's face it, that's not you, is it?"
"And what is me?"
"Thrown alive," laughed Endor. "You're maudlin already, and we haven't even started drinking yet."
"What?"
"Come on," said Endor. "I can see you're thirsty. Let's put that fire out, eh?" Figures had gathered ahead of them, a small group seated on rugs and blankets, around a crackling bonfire, under the wide starlit purple of the desert evening. Eisenhorn could hear talking and laughter. "Look who I found," Endor announced. The figures looked up. Some laughed. One handed Endor a bottle.
"About time you got here," said Midas Betancourt.
He was poking the fire with a stick. The campfire was built in a circle of broken stones, its flames and sparks roaring up into the night. The crackle of the wood was like the churring clicks of insects. Betancourt's cerise jacket looked like blood in the flamelight.
"Another hour or two, and there'd be no bottles left," said Harlan Nail.
He was lying back in an old Selgioni travel rug, his shoulders propped against a boulder.
"I'm sorry,"
Eisenhorn said to him.
"I was joking, boss,"
Nail replied.
"We brought plenty."
"No, I'm sorry," said Eisenhorn.
"You were always so loyal, Harlan, and I got you killed. A crass mistake on my part."
"Just circumstances," Endor said encouragingly.
"Listen to me," Eisenhorn said to Nail. "I shouldn't have trusted Jaff. That was a stupid error. But even before that, before the actual fact of your death, I placed you in danger so many times. I could have got you killed 1,000 times over before I actually did."
"Give him a drink for throne's sake," Midas called out.
"He's maudlin tonight," agreed Endor. "Very maudlin. Up in his head, all brooding, as usual. I told him to lighten up."
"Did that work?"
asked Midas.
"Does it ever?"
snorted Nail. "Here you go," said Kara Swole. She handed Eisenhorn a glass of Amasek.
"Kara,"
he said. He was so tired. His resistance was ebbing. They all looked so young.
"Good to see you again," she replied.
He took the glass. The heat of the fire inside him ignited the vapor of the Amasek. Tiny blue flames danced across the surface of his drink.
"Are you dead too?"
Eisenhorn asked her.
"As good as," she said. "I have walked in your footsteps. Your path only ever leads to one place."
"Kara."
"I'm joking. Throne, what's the matter with you tonight?"
"Some die outright," said a figure on the other side of the fire. "Some just end up damaged. Their lives ended, to all intents and purposes. It amounts to the same thing." Gideon Ravener gazed through the roaring flames of the campfire at him. He seemed much further away than the rest of them. He was young and handsome, his hair tied back in a long horsetail. He raised his glass. "Your health," he said, nodding. Eisenhorn tried to move around the campfire to approach Ravener. The fire somehow contrived to remain between them, keeping Ravener on its far side, constantly watching Eisenhorn through flames.
"Most perturbatory," said Amos, at Eisenhorn's side. "The way the fire moves like that, as if it is sentient, keeping one thing screened from another."
He glanced up at Eisenhorn and sipped his drink.
"Wouldn't you say so, Gregor?" he asked.
"Strange, indeed," said Eisenhorn.
He looked at the old savant.
"Do you recall the torment?" he asked.
"Which one?" asked Amos. "There have been so many."
"The torment, Amos. Ulrin's pox."
Yes. Sequestered order dossier 1767563 triple serif. Docket 991. Entered by rubricator Edric Kallik on..."
"Just the details, Amos."
"The first outbreak was recorded on Pyridi," said Amos, "some 34 years before a second pestilence occurred during the third year of the Genovingian campaign. Ingenious research by the scholars of Materia Medica revealed the plagues to be related forms of the same pathogen. It was untreatable, and the death toll across many infected worlds was immense. Thanks to the work of a recollector called Lemuel Sark, it was eventually identified to be a virus engineered by the ruinous powers. Indeed, its efficacy had been enhanced by Subjunctus Vallis, an apothecary of the Doom Eagles chapter Adeptus Astartes, who had himself succumbed and was under its malign influence. It would seem, you see, the pox had some self-possession. Gregor, a sentience. Ha ha! Just like the fire. Is that why you asked?
Just go on, Amos,
said Eisenhorn. The torment took hold of Vallis's mind, the poor devil, said the old man, pondering the facts as he accessed them from his memory. It acted through him, guiding his work so as to protect itself and propagate its curse.
Amos looked up at Eisenhorn.
Hardly the subject of light conversation at a gathering of friends, he smiled.
The torment, Amos. Might it also be an infectious idea, carried and transmitted by thought as well as body?
Well, I suppose, at a stretch,
Amos shrugged.
And if it was engineered into an inoculant, Amos, an antigenic, to transmit the idea alone, without the physical malady, to infect thought, not matter.
Gregor, said Amos, I have no idea who in the Holy Imperium would have the talent or means to perform such a feat, not even the most gifted magos of Materia Medica.
Unless the torment itself willed it, asked Eisenhorn. Took, let's say, a gifted magos of Materia Medica and showed him how the feat could be achieved. Transformed his mind to devise the technique required.
I would think, said Amos, it would need to also transform his mind to make him even want to do it.
A given, Eisenhorn agreed. So, in such circumstances, how could a man fight the antigenic? How could he stop it corrupting his system?
I don't suspect he could, said Amos. If the torment could overcome the will and physiology of an Adeptus Astartes.
It gets to what is already there, said Ravenna, through the flames. It burns through will to whatever lies beneath. The truth, I suppose you'd call it, prosaically. It doesn't turn a man into a heretic. It merely burns back everything to reveal the heretic that's always been there.
Endor had taken Kara in his arms, and they were laughing and dancing a tight and playful zendoff across the old travel rugs spread out around the fire. There was no music. They were dancing in time to the crackle of the flames, the steady, churring beat of invisible insects, the tick of an old clock, the hum of words unsounded. Midas was clapping along. Nail was opening a bottle. Eisenhorn watched as Nail got up, walked around the campfire, and refilled Ravenna's glass. Ravenna looked up at Nail, smiled. They laughed at some remark.